Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
In this next interview, we dive deep into the world of fascia, one of the largest organ systems of the body, and also it's so important to movement, pain, and so many other physiologic processes in our body and for our health. We have David Lezondek, who's an allied health member in the Department of Family and Community Medicines at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. He serves as the senior structural integrator and fascia specialist at UPMC's Center for Integrative Medicine. David is the author of the international bestseller, Fascia, What It Is and Why It Matters. His follow-up book, Fascia Function and Medical Applications, was nominated for a 2021 British Medical Association Award. He has also contributed chapters to the second edition of Fascia, The Tensional Network of the Human Body, and the second edition of Metabolic Therapies in Orthopedics. He sits on the steering committee of the International Consortium on Manual Therapies. As a passionate and engaging speaker, David has been invited to speak to such diverse groups as the National Institute of Health Workshop on Myofascial Pain, the Performance Health and Wellness Staff for the LA Clippers, both the British and Australian Fascia Symposiums, the World Fascia Congress, the Anatomy Trains Masterclass Series, the University of Arizona Integrative Medicine Medical Alumni Group, and many others. He also produces and hosts the podcast Body Talk with David Lezondek. So listen up, because this interview gives such great insight to what fascia is, why it matters in our body, and what you can do to optimize your fascial health. Also, how to know if a manual therapist or a structural integrator or somebody who's doing myofascial work on you is effective. Let's dive in. David, thanks so much for giving us some time today. We're super excited to have you on to talk fascia. It's not a topic that we've had on our podcast for a while. I guess indirectly we talk about it when we talk about movement, which is one of our primary topics, but thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Happy to be here.
Now, I always am super curious. First of all, what made you dive into the world of fascia?
I found that working with fascia got me more consistent results. So I came to this as a manual therapist about a decade in. And when I discovered fascia for myself and that approach to working, there was that light bulb moment of, oh, this was what I wanted to be doing all along, but I didn't know what it was till it was shown to me. And up until that point, I had had a lot of success being clinically oriented in terms of helping people out with pain and dysfunction, using various methods, various massage therapy methods, muscle energy techniques, PNF, trigger points in the Travell-Simons way. But when I discovered the fascial approach and the literal it's all connected approach, which always was curious to me, I just discovered that I was more easily able to get consistent results and get them quicker.
I love that. And so now if we can break that down a little bit more, fascia, okay. as simply put, like, what is this mystical thing that we call fascia and what's its purpose in our body?
Okay. So as often happens in science, as often happens in medicine, something is discovered and something else is neglected. So fascia is your connective tissue webbing that covers and interpenetrates every muscle, every bone, every nerve, and every organ. That's a lot. So if you cut an orange in half and you look at the pulpy orange sections and think of that as the muscle, but then there's the white stuff in between all the sections, that's like the fascia around the muscles, okay? Except that in a living human body, that material is biodynamic, meaning that it is responsive to mechanical forces and it has the capability of changing aspects of its composition and even its shape. So what I used to tell my patients early on is that you have your muscle, but this is like the envelope that the muscle sits in.
How do you start to work with fascia then?
When you're working with fascia in a clinical setting, in a therapeutic rehabilitative setting, however that goes, it's a different way of tactily approaching the tissue, the quality of touch that you give to the surface and beyond. So there is a feel on the part of the therapist that is different than, say, holding compression on a trigger point or holding a stretch or kneading like a massage therapist does. It's different than that. And also the feel to the person on the table is different than that. So when I say working with fascia, it's its own medium, and working with it as a tissue requires a certain touch or sensitivity to it. Just like if you were a pastry chef, there are different kinds of dough that you make to create different pastries, and you have to handle and play with that dough to get it into the shapes that you want. But the dough has different consistencies based on the properties of the dough. It's a bit that way working with fascia versus working with muscle versus working with joints or doing more traditional PT type things.
All right, so we're going to continue to dive in on what you can do for your fascia and what types of manual therapies are so important for fascial health. But Jen, what would you say is one of the most important things to keep good global fascial health in your body?
Well, it's hydration. We need the slide and glide between the tissues in order for the fascia to be able to move. Like, that is 100% key. And a lot of people aren't getting enough water in throughout the day.
And what's one of the best ways that we have found to stay hydrated is having water that tastes amazing.
Well, element. And it's not just about the taste, I gotta say. And the reason
it's kind of about the taste.
I mean, yes. But the reason I went toward Element especially, and I was so attracted to this brand, is because they don't use any sugar. And a lot of hydration brands out there, a lot of electrolytes, they use sugar or some type of sugar, where Element is just using stevia to kind of sweeten some of these things. But I mean, these flavors are unbelievable and so salty, so good, so delicious.
And the electrolytes are also really important for fascial health too, because another thing that's so important is muscle contraction. And when you're getting enough sodium, when you're getting enough potassium, magnesium, that's something that helps your muscles stay nice and relaxed, but also contract well and keep the fluids moving through your body. And that hydration is just going to keep lubrication in all of those inner layers between the muscles where the fascia is. So if you want to check out Element, you can go down to the link in the show notes. It's just drinkelement.com/optimal. You get a free sample pack with every single purchase. So you continue to try new flavors, and they have some crazy sounding ones, but they're all incredible. All right, now let's continue to get back into our interview with David and talk more about fascia. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great. And I think this is a good time to bust up some myths, because I know that Jen and I are always battling the comments that people make about, like, oh, I just need to break up this fascia or break up this scar tissue. And so what's actually
or
happening?
Take this supplement that's the new hot supplement. I'm actually wearing a t-shirt. You guys can't see it because we're audio only, but it says magic is science that works.
Right.
And I wore it just for you.
Love it.
All right. So what myths do you want to bust up there, Dom?
Well, I think just starting there, and when people say, like, oh, I need to get in and break up this scar tissue or break up this fascia, like, is that something that actually happens? I mean, Jen and I definitely try and educate people on that, but what's actually happening when you, say, have someone who's doing structural integration working on your fascia? What's happening physiologically to that tissue?
Okay, that's a lot to unpack. So let's roll it back just a little bit. So the primary component, the primary molecule of fascia is collagen fibers. Those collagens are produced by a very specific cell in your body, and that cell responds to mechanical information. So it responds to both pressure and vibration. So what that means is that the way you use your body affects the shape of your body, which affects the way the cells spool out the collagen that make up the tissue called fascia. And that over time can either support what you're doing or it can be supportive in a way that you don't like. And this is something that traditionally does not show up on x-rays, MRIs, and so forth. So here's a classic example, because I see it very much these days. I have a number of patients who refer to it as a geek neck or tech neck, but people are always, you know, down looking at their phones, or a lot of their work is in front of a computer, and that requires a certain repetitive motion. I'm sure you guys know all about repetitive motion syndromes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So if I spend 4 or 5 hours in the typical bad posture on my phone with my head looking down and my shoulders forward of the midline of my body and down a little bit, and that's me 4 to 5 hours a day, let's say, over a period of 9 to 16 months, the cells that weave the collagen in that area, which is constantly turning over, are going to respond to that repetitive posture, that repetitive motion, in a way that supports that activity. So if I'm trying to learn a new skill, that's awesome. If I'm getting stuck in a pattern that optimally is going to give me neck aches, shoulder aches, and maybe even compromise my breathing and my circulation in my hands and arms, i.e. carpal tunnel, thoracic outlet syndromes, not so good.
Yeah.
But because these cells respond to mechanical information, if we can stimulate them in a way that reprograms it them to weave the collagen in another way, then we get a good lasting therapeutic result. I tell all my patients, and here's another myth buster for you guys, that if you're going to a fascia therapist and it's a year later and you're still seeing them, go to someone else, please. This is a therapy that should have an endpoint at some point.
Yeah.
Some have it quicker than others. So basically, sorry, reel me in here, Dom, I kind of went off on a tangent.
No, I think this is great.
Yeah, and I think this is what's important for people to understand. And I love that you said the fact of it stimulating the tissue to create, you know, a different response, rather than what I think people traditionally, you know, go in and they're trying to get the work they think they need is by breaking something apart.
Or realigning something or this or that. And they think it's going to be just a one session treatment. And so as you're doing this stimulation of these mechanoreceptors to start getting this collagen to lay down differently, like what else might that patient or that client be doing to help with that, to help give the messages?
That's where I wanted to go. Thank you, Dom. That was exactly the train.
I'll lead you in.
So what's happening there is the person on the table, if the work is going the way it should, has what is traditionally called a release. And I have been saying for a while now that I think we need to redefine release to be the subjective experience that the person feels of something letting go. Because that's what it feels like to the person on the table. Something that was under tension suddenly is under less tension, and something lets go. That is almost always, but not always, but almost always, followed by a change in pliability on the part of the person doing the therapy. So if you're doing your therapy properly, you are engaging with the patient in a way that helps them understand and explore what's changed in their body, and giving them strategies when they're not in your treatment room so that what you just did endures. So, you know, what I'm doing when somebody comes to see me, using my best diagnostic capabilities, which are usually looking at issues like their posture, their alignment, whatever you want to call it, and trying to correlate it to their problem. That tells me where to work. And then showing them, okay, here's what you want to do to sustain that change. So I usually give somebody a very simple movement exercise and Zen homework. So let's just pick something simple. I've got somebody with a leg problem, and part of that pattern is hyperextended knees. So the knees look straight in profile in the back. And they're like, oh, yeah, wow, that's better. That's less strain on my legs. Okay, great. So throughout the day, just ask yourself, where are my knees? because we'll have the default pattern of wanting to go back to the place that I'm making it easier for them to get out of.
Mm-hmm.
So they can become aware when they're brushing their teeth, when they're standing at the sink, when they're cooking dinner, whenever they're doing normal activities, just ask themselves, where are my knees? And then go have a moment to go, oh, wait, I can make a different choice now because I'm aware of what's going on there. So that message, that mechanical message of we want some more slack in this area and less tension continues to be driven by the person trying to make the change.
So incredibly important, and something that I think is often missed when it's like, let me go get manual treatment and then not have that awareness factor any other time functionally throughout life, which doesn't really help to create the change we ultimately want to make with patients and with clients and people to actually feel something different. Now, when I like that you kind of touched on this idea of release, and can we unpack that a little bit more to help educate on what is that subjective feeling really doing then physiologically? What happens when I feel that release? Is tissue lengthening? Did I get out of a knot? Did I break up scar tissue? I mean, these are all the things that people are being told is happening. What is really happening when they feel that sensation of release?
It's funny. Every time you say break up scar tissue, I have this like picture in my head of a tiny jackhammer going.
Right.
So, okay, that's a really good question. So there is a change in the tensional state of that area or even the body, probably happening via the mechanoreceptors and also some change in the ground substance itself. Mm-hmm. I think that's what accounts for some of that melting feel, the liquid part of the fascia. For your listeners, because it's both fiber and fluid, and the ratio between fiber and fluid changes based on where you are in the body and also the tissue state itself, but that's a different conversation. So, you know, is something lengthening? Potentially.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly seen things that look as if things are lengthening. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you take something that's under tension and you reduce the tension, it allows the opportunity for change. But where to me, the secret sauce is that you've got to apply it in a systematic way, not just a symptomatic way.
Mm.
So if somebody comes to see me for carpal tunnel and I just work from the elbow down, the problem could be in the medial intermuscular septum along the inside of the arm, the space between the tricep and the bicep, or up in the shoulder joint itself, where the pecs, there's the major pec, and then there's the under pec, the pectoralis minor. That has a very distinct tensional relationship between the shoulder and the middle part of the rib cage. So that can be involved too. And then there are muscles along the front of the neck that connect to the first and second ribs called the scalenes. So all those areas could be involved in that pathology down the arm, and they all need to be checked and assessed in order to get a more thorough release, if you will. So there is in my viewpoint, the subjective, that is the part of the patient or the client's sense, their interoception, that there is a change in tension that they like. And again, on my part, there is definitely a change in the pliability of the tissue that allows for the possibility, if they're paying attention when they're off the table and exercising this ability to move in a different way or to become aware of, oh, I'm putting tension in my body where I don't need it. So since people drive to come see me, I usually have them start with the steering wheel. You'll become aware of how tightly you're gripping the steering wheel when you're in traffic. Things like that. Where am I using more force than is necessary? I can't give you a textbook definition of this is what's going on when someone has a release, but we need to get beyond the idea of, oh, that released, so that means it's never going to tighten up again.
Right.
Because that's not always the case.
Yes.
Or that where we think we need the release may not be actually the most important part that's holding that tensional pattern in place. And that's a hard one times for a lot of people. Sometimes the area they're complaining about, and I'm sure you've seen this, is an area that's overworking because another place isn't working.
Yeah, I think you're touching in on something that's really important. A few things there, that interconnectedness or the dependency of different areas of our body on how one certain area feels. And that, you know, Jen and I try teaching that all the time with movement. Like, yeah, you may have low back pain, or that may be where you're feeling the most tension. That doesn't mean you just need to hammer away at the low back with different modalities or different treatments. It might indeed be in your hips or in your ankles. I mean, we just did a little barefoot course, and a lot of people were coming to us saying, like, that sounds great. I don't have issues with my feet. Like, no, this is for everyone. And I think that that's something that we need to continue to ingrain in people. So can you talk a little bit as to why do fascial or tissue issues in my feet and ankles, why might that affect me up the chain in my back or my upper back or neck even?
In certain biomechanical models, the feet are of primary importance because we're standing. Now we're opting more into a sitting culture. But predominantly, we are a standing species, which makes me think about the IT band, which I'll say something about in a moment. But our ability to stand in a balanced way so that our weight is relatively evenly distributed between our heel and the balls of our feet is very important. When we don't, that can create over time, I'm talking months and years, a gradual reorganization of the connective tissue matrix, the fascia, around that imbalance. So here's a good example. I work with a lot of runners, and I notice it particularly in their middle years, in their 40s and 50s, things are different for them. And I have people coming in with shin splint issues. And when I look at them in profile, I can almost always see that the tibia, the lower leg bone, is tilted slightly forward on the foot itself, indicating a tightened shin muscle, the tibialis anterior, and likewise an overstretched calf muscle. They may come in complaining about their calves, but the area that often needs to be treated is the front of the calves, the tibialis anterior, the shin muscle. Then they start getting some of the relief that they need. And that pathology can continue all the way up into the pelvis and beyond. That's just a starting point, for example. So we haven't mentioned the C word yet, compensation. You know, how am I compensating to take pressure off the part that doesn't want more pressure? And then, of course, you're going to love this because I get this a lot now. So-and-so referred you to me because they said I have tight hamstrings. So-and-so referred me to you because I have IT band syndrome. Yeah. And of course, my question is always, well, why do you have tight hamstrings? Why do you have IT band syndrome? You know, that doesn't, just because you can put a label on it, doesn't tell you how to treat it or where to treat it.
Right.
So if we go up from the previous example of the tibialis anterior and the shin splints, that could, as a compensation for that, create a more forward kneecap, which would also create an imbalance in the upper leg, kind of like a Jacob's ladder toy, if people still play with those things. So that you've got a lower leg that's tight in the front, short in the front, long in the back, and an upper leg that's short in the back and long in the front. So those hamstrings might be tight in a pattern like that. Because they are chronically shortened. Usually tight hamstrings I see are tight because they're chronically lengthened. And there's actually a tilt in the pelvis that the sticky outy bit, the bony bit in the back of the pelvis, called the PSIS for short and the ASIS for short in the front, PSIS in the back, are not within 7 degrees of each other, which is considered the normal range. And if that relationship is imbalanced, you can over time have tight hamstrings because they're too long because the pelvis is tipped too far forward. So you can stretch that till the cows come home and it's not going to change the tight hamstrings. So you have to look and you have to make some assessments as to why they're tight. Then there's a person I saw once who, you know, they didn't have any imbalances, but they overworked them constantly because they didn't want to get them. I had somebody show up once with IT band syndrome who said, "I don't understand it. I've been using a foam roller half an hour a day for a month and my IT bands don't feel any better." You're supposed to laugh at that one.
No, we did. Don't worry.
Or have you seen that too?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the most common thing I think I always am seeing is just someone who has been told they have IT band syndrome and they just need to roll out their IT band. Can we talk about that a little bit more? What does, you know, putting pressure and trying to roll out the IT band even do?
Increasingly, I'm convinced more and more, not a lot.
And why is that?
Because we aren't born with an IT band. We form an IT band by learning how to walk on two legs. Mm-hmm. And the IT band is basically designed to hold you up. There could be an argument made with a soft roller, and that's really important. The one thing we're really clear on these days is that the roller that you use, softer is better. You're more likely to injure yourself with a hard one. I can remember when I was working with a yoga therapist over a decade ago, and they were fanatical about using wood blocks for things as opposed to the soft ones. And I went along with it. But today I would say, oh, no. We're going to use the soft blocks here. Mm. So when I'm treating an IT band, I'm working the margins. So something we haven't talked about yet is the WD-40. So you talked about scarring earlier, Jen.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned the A word, adhesions. But what often happens are what we're calling in fascia science, densifications. Mm. So all the muscles and nerves and other things secrete a substance called hyaluronan, colloquially known as hyaluronic acid. But I'd prefer it if you think of it as WD-40. Yeah. If you have enough WD-40, the hinges don't creak and everything slides. It's the same with your muscles. Now, when things don't move appropriately or they are sufficiently immobilized long enough, that WD-40 for your muscles, which is secreted by cells that live in the fascial layers between the muscles, gets thick and gummy. Mm. That can impede movement, and that can also send pain signals from the mechanoreceptors that live in the same spaces between the muscles because things aren't sliding and gliding the way that they should. So where I would say to apply your roller is along the margins of the IT band, between the IT band and the hamstring in the rear, and between the IT band and the vastus lateralis in the front, more towards the front, to make sure that that IT band is gliding as much as possible on top of those muscles.
Love that. I think that is such key for people to continue to understand and kind of start to wrap their head around. But another thing, I want to go back just real quick as to why softer is better than a hard tool.
And again, that's going to be relative. Yeah. So if I'm a 320-pound power lifter, I'm probably going to need a harder tool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Then somebody who works in an office and goes to yoga twice a week. The reason that there should be a little bit of conforming. So when I'm teaching manual therapy, I tell my students to use a conforming hand rather than imposing your hand on their structure. Let your hand form to the contours around the area that you're treating. It should be similar with your tools. There should be a little bit of give so that you can negotiate what is a comfortable amount of pressure. As I tell people who I'm seeing for plantar fasciitis, it's like, here's a tennis ball. Use this tennis ball because golf balls have no mercy.
Mm-hmm. True.
Mm-hmm. Whereas very you can true. Negotiate with the tennis ball. And if you're using a tool that's too hard for you, you can actually wind up damaging your tissue. In some cases, there's a few cases on record quite severely, but even at the less severe end, you could be recreating an inflammation that never completely goes away. And who wants that? Mm.
I'm just having flashbacks of even when I was in PT school and we're doing different manual techniques. I was very lucky to have some different mentors that kind of taught me that concept of like working with the body that's in front of you rather than doing your manual technique on the person, because I would see classmates or different people working on just people on the bed that are just writhing underneath the amount of pressure that they're using, and I'm like, you're not, think about that person's nervous system, it's under attack right now. what are those tissues going to be doing? And so I also think it's important that you bring up that it's relative. I, for example, am somebody who's relatively larger, have some more sticky points. I played football in college, so my nervous system is relatively blunted from from different sensations, right. And I take a little more pressure for my nervous system to say, "Oh, hey, I'm gonna accept that, and I'm gonna change because of that." Versus Jen, who was a gymnast, is a little more bendy than I am at baseline, and likes very much so a much softer tool to conform and work with her system.
Yeah,
and some of that can be a little bit of trial and error, discovering which person is what type, and it can change within the person themselves. Some areas might need a much more subtle approach, and other areas might need a much more unsubtle approach, shall we say, within the same person.
Yeah,
but I really enjoy, in particular because structural integration, Rolfing is one of the brand names, and Rolfing is, well, oh yeah, that's that stuff that hurts. And I'm like, no, this is kinder, gentler Rolfing. I love it when people come in who require a lighter, more sensitive touch, not because that means I have to take it easy, but because that just it requires me to use my tools, my hands, my forearms, and so forth, in different ways to achieve the same effect. Mm-hmm. So I have to concentrate in a very different way. And I'm thinking about this one patient who came in knowing that they were super sensitive. And I assured them up front that I would meet them somewhere in the middle. And I have to tell you, the pliability of their tissue, my ability to sink into deeper layers or perceive that I'm sinking into deeper layers, the pliability was there, but the nervous system didn't react the way that you would expect in somebody who had that kind of pliability. So if I remember working on the cervical region, and it felt like there was the bottom of a hard-boiled egg about 2 inches above where my fingertips were, okay? Now, again, this is an approximation, listeners, of like the way my brain is trying to assess what my palpation, which is diagnosis by touch, is telling me. But I also knew that if I went through the tissue, even though the tissue was pliable, to get to that egg, we were not going to have a good outcome for this person. So we waited. It was like waiting for that egg to drop into my hand. And that was a more extreme case. So usually the cases that that I see who are more sensitive can take a bit more of an active approach. So I'm not sure what all the perhaps biopsychosocial factors were for that patient. But that was one of the more extreme versions of that. So you have to meet people where they're at. And you might feel like you didn't do enough in that particular treatment compared to what you normally do. But if the person got the result they wanted, you did your job.
Mm-hmm. And what do you tell patients as to the sensation that they're looking for? Because I know a lot of patients do go in with the mindset of, all right, this is going to hurt. I'm going to be, you know, in pain this whole time. So what is kind of the sensation that someone should be assessing or looking for?
I tell them that there may be times where I have 90% of their attention, and that's okay. I tell them that if they find themselves bracing, you know, like when you're at the dentist and you think you're relaxed and then you realize you're not as relaxed as you thought you were.
Yeah.
That's okay. I tell them that is a sign that I could modify what I'm doing in some way that makes it easier for you. So you need to tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you're doing too much, you will feel a tension under your hands. If you're doing something manual, if you're trying to force something, or you should. But sometimes there's a more subtler tension that you may not feel. Or you may have somebody like you, Dom, who needs a high amount of stimulation, but in this place, not so much. And you might be kind of stoic about it. So those are kind of the two cues that I give everybody. And the other thing about when you're getting what is being described as a fascia oriented treatment is that it should go very slowly. Mm. And I explain that we go slow because the tissue responds better to slow. And we're going to find those potholes. We're going to find those speed bumps. And you know, when you go over a speed bump at 30 miles an hour, that shakes everything up. We're not going to do that here. So when we find those speed bumps, we'll be able to navigate our way over them or around them so that we get the best result possible. So I find that even just letting them know that, and I tell them in at any time, you can tell me stop or you can tell me wait.
Yeah. I like that speed bump analogy.
Yeah.
It makes me think of driving around a busy parking lot and that busy parking lot being the body. And as long as you take it nice and easy, if somebody backs out of a spot really quick or you hit one of those speed bumps, which might be a place of extra tension that can cause a response in somebody, you're taking it at that nice, easy pace.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
One of my favorite things that I think you've mentioned so far is probably that Zen exercise that you mentioned early on. And I think that was Zen homework. And I think that was a subtle mention that is so profound, because again, as physical therapists or many clinicians might assign just an exercise homework, but again, people think that I did my exercise and now I'm done. When in reality, our tissues are always responding to all the stimuli that are coming in. So the more that you can consistently bring your mind back to that awareness, the more that you are going to be influencing the tissue in that area. So I want everyone to take away that Zen homework and think about where's your trouble issue? What have you had happen in life that might bring you back to that awareness on a daily or a more consistent basis throughout the day? What are some other things that people can do at home that is going to be good for their global fascial health?
Oh, that's a biggie. That's a biggie. I do want to refine that in terms of the Zen homework.
Yeah.
I just find that if you're going to practice this, listeners, I always find it better to phrase it in the essence of Zen in a non-judgmental question format, like, where are my knees?
Yeah.
Where are my shoulders? Where is my head? Whatever it is. So there's an element of discovery and curiosity about it. And that kind of takes any judgment away, because we tend to be a little harsher on ourselves than I think we need to be. And then it becomes a better experience doing the Zen homework. I would say that without specifically knowing what sort of changes you want to engender, because everybody's different, the biggest thing that I could say is change up how you do what you do once in a while. So we are creatures of habit, and those habits on a biomechanical way get woven into the reality of our fascial net. So, you know, if you're a right-hander, brush your teeth with your left hand sometimes. Back when we used to have the phones on the cords in the kitchen and we would be on our phones while we were washing the dishes, we would crook the phone on one shoulder or the other shoulder. But we don't do that anymore. But that's the kind of thing that I'm saying. We tend to do things in a particular way. Now, as somebody who plays guitar to relax, I'm not suddenly going to learn to suddenly play guitar left-handed. I'm not going to go to that extreme. But, you know, take two steps at a time instead of one step at a time once in a while. I mean, just find different ways. Turn on the light with your foot. Actually, it's really fun when you're waiting for an elevator and there's other people there is to, you know, press the up button with your foot and go, yeah, I'm 50, deal with it. So, you know, just feel free to move in a little more less prescribed manner. My favorite thing in the world for your overall global fascial thing, and people may look at you funny, but I'm going to tell you, it's skipping.
Mm.
Because skipping involves bounce. It involves another quality we call elastic recoil. Skipping, when you get the rhythm right, uses very little energy for the amount of return you get in momentum.
Mm.
So if you're going to do some power walking or some running or some interval training, put some skips in between. Skip for 30 seconds or a minute is part of that.
And it's also just hard not to smile while you're skipping. So that's another.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I would love to see, like, you know, let's have a skipping race instead of a 5K or a 10K.
Right? I mean, it would be fun.
We just had a 5K here in my little town for 4th of July. We have it every year, and I was at the after brunch for that. I did not run in it. I'm suddenly picturing all those people skipping that thing. I could not see them doing it, but it'd be really good for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that. And I think there we've touched on different tools now that you can use to just tap into your own system and help. And where would someone know to, if they're like, you know, this sounds really interesting, I would love to get this kind of work done on myself. How does someone know to go to a fascial therapist?
Okay. Well, if you are having a chronic problem that does not seem to be resolving, that is usually the strongest indicator. And that can be everything up to and including, I've had an MRI, I've had x-rays, I've had this test, I've had that test, I've had the other test, and nobody knows what to do with it. I go to the chiropractor, it feels good, but it isn't lasting. I've had people tell me, wow, this is what I wanted massage therapy to do when they get up off the table. And mm-hmm. please don't take that as a diss, massage therapists who may be listening. So if people are coming back to you with the same problems and they're not resolving, if you're a therapist, that might be a good time to refer them out. And you have to understand here, I work in a department where I work with 2 chiropractors, 3 acupuncturists, several movement specialists, a massage therapist, and a couple of psychotherapists. So we all kind of have a good feel for who's got what pieces. And and how we all have to integrate and work together. So that's the one thing. If you were sitting there, though, and you're saying, hey, every time I do X, I feel Y, and it isn't good, and it can feel better, but it never gets better, that to me is a good sign that some version of fascial or myofascial therapy might be the ticket that you need. And any good myofascial therapist worth their salt, if you're not getting sustainable results within 3 visits, should be the first one to tell you, wow, I don't think that's what's going on. Because that's really, really important that you get a result that you notice for a couple of days. And even as the symptoms come back, they're different each time between visits.
I think that's great to keep in mind. Is there a good place or a good way for people to find or seek out a fascial therapist or someone who does structural integration?
Well, there's a lot of different brands out there, and I think more so because fascia is becoming one of the hot new things, which I kind of like, and like everything else, kind of don't. There is the IASI, which is the International Association of Structural Integrators, and they're a reliable resource for finding practitioners in your area. There is not one overarching organization for fascia-oriented therapists, so can't really point you in that direction. But there are a lot of different people who also incorporate it into their therapy. So probably the best thing you can do if you're sitting there at home is to get on your search engine and put in fascia, put in therapy, put in myo, M-Y-O, fascia therapy in your town, and see what comes up. Look at the bios of the people that are doing the therapy. Do they have patient-client testimonials? Do those people actually put both their names on their testimonials? And get a feel for which one, yeah, this seems to be the person that's right for me. You can tell a lot by where a person goes to school and how they pitch their biography, their professional biography, and see if they're a good fit. But the International Association of Structural Integrators, specifically for that, is certainly a good place to start. I'll be sure to give you that link in the show notes.
Amazing. And I know, I mean, for anyone who wants to dive deeper on understanding fascia, understanding why it's important, where can people go to find the books that you have written?
They're pretty much available everywhere in the world on Amazon. There are 2. One is written for medical professionals and people in the healthcare industry. That's called Fascia Function in Medical Applications. You'll know which one it is because it's the one that costs more. But the one that is copiously illustrated and written to be accessible with a high level of science, but nonetheless accessible to therapists and practitioners throughout professions and disciplines, but also to the general highly interested reader, is Fascia, What It Is and Why It Matters. And that's also available on Amazon.
Amazing. And people get to look out because you have a second edition to this book coming out this year?
Yes, I do. Thank you for mentioning that, Jen. Fascia, What It Is, Why It Matters, second edition, now with 30% more science, comes out in September. Might be done a little bit earlier, but we're shooting for the beginning of September for the big Fascia Science Research Congress that's happening in September. And that should be up for pre-order on Amazon very, very soon.
Amazing. Well,
amazing. Congrats on that. That's a big accomplishment coming out with second edition. And I'm sure there will be more because, as you just mentioned with the 30% more science comment, science will continue on with whether we continue with it or not.
It's pretty typical for a science book to be updated every 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Because things will change.
Yeah, and exactly.
The information will get stale if it isn't. So
for sure. We'll get all that linked up down in the show notes. Encourage everyone to continue to explore their own fascia and dive in on some more of David's information. If anything in this podcast sounded of interest to you, David, thanks so much for taking time and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thanks so much for joining us on another episode. Now, if you want to find some of that fascial work, I do know of MyoDetox, which is really popular here in LA, but I know that they're expanding and they're trying to hit other big metro areas, and they are very popular in Canada as well, especially Vancouver and Toronto. So if you are looking for some fascial work, MyoDetox is a great place to go and get that done. Now, if you missed out on the barefoot course that we mentioned throughout this podcast, you can still go to the foot and ankle plan on Gen Health and start to work and build that foundation, because like we said, it is going to touch on so much up the chain. So go check out Gen Health if you haven't yet. It's just gen.health, or we'll link it down in the show notes, and we'll see you next time on another episode from the Optimal Body Podcast.